The 1979 World Almanac and Book of Facts is out, and it says that in 1977, there were 55,327 marriages in Tennessee and 28,227 divorces. But nationwide, in the same year, there were 2,100,000 marriages, 1,100,000 divorces. Every time I look seriously at the columns in the newspapers, which are published almost on a daily basis, and just compare the length of the marriages column with the divorces column, I realize again how many people are having their lives and their homes torn apart, and how desperately we need some help. It seems to me that in the history of mankind, there have been three basic forms of society. And each one of those forms has had its influence on the home. From the beginning down to about 1850 AD, we lived in agrarian societies. All the families virtually were agriculturally based. They were placed in rural settings. The families worked together. They ate nearly every meal together. They had recreation together, worshiped together. They even studied together because the center of education was the home. But then around 1850, the machine age began, or the industrial age, and families which had been based in the family began to move to the city where factories were and where assembly lines were set up for mass production. Fathers were taken out of the home first, and later mothers, to work in those factories. Fathers were treated very impersonally in the factory. Mothers found nearly all the parenting chores falling to them, and children found themselves being educated in the public school system. And then somewhere in recent years, we've passed from the industrial age into a still later age, either a technopolitan age or a computer age, where now we've moved out of the cities into the suburbs. Both mother and father generally work. Families are on the go so much that they go through many days without having a single meal together. They almost never work together. They have little opportunity for serious talk with one another. Television at an earlier and earlier age begins to influence thinking and values. And we find ourselves moving, pulling up roots, going from one place to another without deep relationships. 1 in 5 families in America moving every year. And at least a part of our problem in holding the family together and making it strong may be that we're still trying to apply the principles of the agrarian age to our computerized age. That we haven't faced up to the reality that life is different for many of us, whether we want it to be or not, and that the family has to make its adjustments to that new way of living. It may be nice to think about the old days, but we aren't living in them. And somehow we have to make the transition. But I think besides the change in the climate of the times, there's just a lot of confusion about the family in our time. I used to think, I suppose it's natural to think, when one grows up in a stable home and when he's always taught what homes are supposed to be, that when people do not act that way, they are not confused, they simply want to act another way. But the reading I do and the association I have with people indicates to me that there is a great deal of confusion about the home. If it isn't a matter of people not knowing what they ought to do, they face problems they aren't sure how to cope with. For example, what is a home anyway? What is a family? The sheer definition of the family may be a problem in our time. There was a time when we could very simply define it. It's the group of people who live together in any household. But that will not necessarily work today. What about the Charles Manson family? Or that type of family unit? Or those many instances where a man and woman live together in one household but without benefit of marriage license or without any intention of marrying. Or the instances we read of with more frequency of homosexually oriented people who want to marry someone of the same sex. The definition of the family would seem to be in a state of confusion and trouble in our society today. The future of the family contributes to that confusion, especially when we talk about predictions of the future. Alvin Toffler, in his Future Shock, predicted that the time would come when women who are rising to higher and higher executive positions in companies would be moving to a new community without the husband needing to make the same move. Or the husband would move, but the wife has a very important job in this community and she doesn't want to move. And Toffler predicted that the husband might move to a new community and start associating with a new family, and the wife and the remainder of the family in the older community would simply take in a new husband, and that we would change families about the same way we change houses today. That seems incredible, but it's confusing to think the possibility may be near. Or maybe the women's movement as a whole has contributed to this confusion. After all, we have a situation where, on the one hand, people say equal pay ought to bring, or equal work ought to bring equal pay. That seems reasonable enough. If the woman is equally qualified, she bears equal responsibility, why shouldn't she be paid as well as the man? And on the other hand, there are many people who are concerned that we're entering a genderless society where the roles of men and women are going to be so intertwined that there's no difference. And that would be bad. It's confusing. I think even the statistics we hear about the home are at times confusing. To know that 2 out of 3 homes have a husband and wife living in them, that 7 out of 10 children are born in a first family marriage, which is still together, but many of them will see that marriage come apart, that 4 out of 10 mothers of preschool children work, most of them full-time, and more than half the mothers of school-age children work, most of them full-time. 1 out of 6 children is growing up in a one-parent home. Over 1 million teenage adolescents run away from home every year. Just the amount of statistics of this kind, including ones I started with about divorces in Tennessee and marriages in Tennessee or nationwide in 1977, that whole ream of statistics becomes confusing and upsetting. If there are all of these factors contributing to the breakup of the family, it isn't surprising that as a climax, divorces become so easy. No-fault divorce in many states. That it's just easier to go that way than it is to struggle through problems for many people. There was a time when divorce was embarrassing, when the court procedure would be very strenuous for everybody involved. Most of that is behind us now. There are a few well-publicized cases. But for the most part, divorce has become so easy and sexual morality is changing so much that one can move out of his home and into another home with great ease, and the marriage or the family unit is in trouble from another standpoint. Where do we turn for help? I'm sure you would expect that a minister would say to the Bible, that's where we have to go. But I think we can also learn from history. I don't know of any strong society that ever developed unless there were strong family units in it. I know a number of societies that have tried an aberration from that rule. For example, Russia, in the early days of her revolution, decided to experiment with a family. The family unit was considered impermanent, flexible. Children were reared outside the home for the most part, very little contact with parents. And there were collective family units who shared living quarters. But Russia has long since gone away from that to the encouragement of traditional, stable family values. When Israel began as a nation in the late 1940s, the kibbutz was very popular. The kibbutz features a well-arranged house for the children who are brought into contact very seldom with their parents. And again, the communal nature of living was pushed as one way to get an infant nation going. But Israel has also gone away from that largely. Some kibbutzes still exist, but they've been modified, and the values of the family are being emphasized again. In the United States, it's easy to talk about our problems, but I really believe we may have already turned the corner. Mary Jo Bain's book, Here to Stay, 20th Century American Marriages, or Jane Howard's bestseller, Families, both glorify the family and indicate that a number of leaders in America, not from a religious base particularly, are beginning to say that there is probably more commitment to the marriage relationship in America today than there has ever been in American history. That seems incredible in view of the statistics. But it may be that we have turned or are turning the corner. It seems to me that in the Bible, from the very beginning, the role of the family is so obvious, no one can miss it. God chooses Abraham. Through you and your family, your children, your descendants, I'm going to bless all nations of men. Family after family within that unit will be chosen and especially blessed and used. And in the New Testament, the family is still a basic unit of society. It's the place where the word is taught, where values are created. All of that leads us back to our text. Here in Ephesians 5, Paul has talked about the promise that we make, the I willness of marriage. And what makes that promise what it should be and what the family can do for individuals and for society. I haven't gone through and tried to line out a word for each of the things the family does, but here are some of the things that I see in the text that Paul is saying the family provides, some of its functions. One of those functions is personal relationships. W.H. Auden, the poet, said, "We must love one another or die." I think he was right. We have to have a place where intimacy is learned, experienced, expressed, and that happens for most of us first in the family. Families are on the go today, and we begin to see alternatives developing where people look for intimacy somewhere else. They're the quick service intimacy outlets like therapy groups who meet together for some kind of encounter, sharing sessions, all sorts of ways ranging all the way to the cocktail party where people look for instant intimacy. But what Paul is saying here is that personal relationships, loving the wife as Christ loves the church, nourishing and cherishing her as he takes care of the church, indicates that it's in the home. And the next chapter indicates that children find the same kind of personal relationships in the home. We only become persons in relationship with other persons. Somewhere I read a quotation from a children's book. It's very, very impolite to turn off mom and kiss the light. Children were being told that relationships are important and we have to keep people at the center of those relationships. And that's what Paul is saying in the text. A second thing here is that education takes place in the home. I read recently that 4 out of 10 parents do not trust public education to teach their children to read and write. And I don't recite that statistic to foster the cause of private education as over against public education, because I know there's a great deal of good public education going on. But I doubt whether any parent can fully trust any school system to carry on the education of the family. For the last 14 years, the scores on the scholastic aptitude tests of young people leaving high school and entering college have been in decline. Recently, a $600,000 two-year-long study was completed, and the volume is about 8 inches thick, and I haven't read it. But I've read something of a summary of the bottom line of that study of what's happening in the education of our children. And it seems that two factors are getting the bad credit. One of them is the disruption of the family. The fact that so many children are living in one-parent families and aren't receiving the help with education they should have. And the other is a lack of hard work at home on school lessons. Reminders that the education of the child eventually comes back to the home. Personal relationships, education, there's just physical maintenance, the meeting of physical needs which has to occur in the home. Economics are so closely connected with our homes that we have courses in most of our schools called home economics. And that's where a young person is supposed to learn how to make money and how to spend money and how to give away money, how to deal with stewardship in every area of life, physical maintenance. In our very youngest years, we have no alternative. In our older years, we still need the support of that physical family unit. And then from the home, we also gain values that influence life. Paul talks a good bit about those values based again on God's love as revealed in Jesus Christ. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. It's an awesome thing to realize how children learn values. I remember very few times in my life when either my father or my mother seated me and said, look, I'm going to tell you a little bit about values. That just doesn't happen in homes ordinarily. But as I look back now, I can see where I learned values. One learns values by the way a parent handles a telephone conversation. Is he telling the truth? Is there honesty and integrity here? By the way one comments about something in the news. By the consistency with which one stands up for what is right in his or her life. A child's mind is like a little computer just storing all those things in a memory bank. And one day feeding his or her own life out of the storehouse. Values are learned in the home unconsciously more often than consciously. And then the home functions as the place where children are conceived and born and reared. It may be that with a population explosion or without it, there are reasons to limit the size of a family. There may be special circumstances in the family that indicate that no children should be born in that family. But in the Bible, there's a great deal of anticipation and yearning for the child to be born and great deal of joy when the child is born, indicating that something important goes on in the home in terms of child rearing. And then the family serves the function of teaching its members how to be serving in society, serving individuals. After all, a family does not exist for itself. We're enablers. We help one another to serve the broader needs of the community. Family that lives only for itself withers. But the family that learns to serve is learning a vital lesson. It's an informative thing to just pass through the New Testament and substitute the word family wherever the word church is found. So often it works. The equipping of the family for the work of ministry. Paul is talking about the body, but that's part of what goes on in the family. It's a serving place. And finally, religious growth and development take place in the family. We may think the church will develop our children, their religious instincts, their religious knowledge, but a child is in Bible school 1 or 2 hours a week. A child is in school 40 hours a week, 35 weeks a year. And the same child is at home 50 to 60 hours a week, 52 weeks a year. And the religious development has to fall back to the home. That's where prayer is learned. It's where Bible study is learned. Where reverence for God is learned. Religious development has to come back to the example, parents. Unconscious as often as conscious. The functions of the home, Paul has pointed to, but they're all summed up in that word love. It's significant to me that Paul does not use the word for romance. He uses the verb form of the noun agape. And that's a word that involves will. I may not be romantically attracted to another person, but I can love that person in the agape sense when I will to love that person. It's a matter of caring, concern, wanting good for the other individual. Not a romantic attachment at all. People fall in love, they fall out of love. In the romantic sense. But in the sense Paul is talking about, a marriage can be made to work by two committed people. It's a working relationship between two people. It's something that can be willed, that can enjoy commitment and determination. C.S. Lewis looked at the problems marriage faces in our time and he says, it looks as if we all must become Christians. His point in a satirical way was, it looks like there's no other alternative if the home is to endure, but that all of us shall begin to live by Christian principles. And why not? The home, the place where personal relationships are learned, where education goes on, where physical maintenance is learned, where values are taught, where children are born and reared, where service is learned, and where religious development takes place. All built on the example of Christ and his love for the church. Just becoming a Christian is not going to make your home magically what you want it to be. But I don't think it's ever going to be what you want it to be any other way. That's going to be the finest start you can make. Do you need to obey God? Would you? While we sing today.